Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, and especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts. Free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate. Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with my co-host, Teresa Martin. Hi, Teresa.
Hello, Lou.
Welcome. Teresa's one of our agents at our company. Buying and selling homes, land, or farms in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia, just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T Bank in downtown Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. Please make note of our changes. Our company, new company website is www.allsuttonproperties.com. That's allsuttonproperties.com. Make sure you check us out. Program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at around 10 a.m. right after the show. So stay tuned. Our guest today is Dr. Heck Morder and Jim Blackburn of the Soil Value Exchange in Houston, Texas. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're going to talk about something fascinating, and we're going to talk about carbon credits in the show today. I got one question before we get started. When did all this start? What was the germ of carbon credits? When did that happen and why?
Well, actually, Hank and I came from two different directions. My work originates at the Severe Storm Center, the SSPEED, or Speed Center, at Rice University. Goes back to about 2010, and we were looking for economic solutions to flooding and trying to figure ways to pay landowners that had low-lying coastal land, figure out how to pay them for keeping their lands natural, because Hurricane Ike had come and had flooded a lot of the natural lands, the marshes, the coastal prairies, and they recovered almost immediately, whereas human settlements were destroyed. So we tried to find ways to compensate landowners and found out that we thought that if we worked it right, we might be able to figure out how to pay landowners for putting carbon dioxide into the soil, into the land that they own. This happens naturally, but there's really no system set up to reward landowners. And so my journey came from flood control this direction. And Hank, you want to talk about your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to work for Shell, and I lost a role in Shell's in a group called Shell Game Changer, where we invested in people with kind of crazy ideas. And a professor from Arizona State University came to us with the idea that you can store very large amounts of atmospheric carbon in soil grasslands. And if you do that, you're not only storing carbon in grasslands, but you also restore water resilience, you restore the grassland ecology and all these wonderful things, and the ranch becomes more profitable. And we start to think, yeah, right, we don't believe in fairy tales, so where's the flaw in this whole story? And we started to invest in that, collect a little bit of data from a couple of ranches, and the more you start thinking about it, the more data you collect, the more you study this, the more you come to the conclusion that this is completely obvious. So that's how it all started, and that's how I started to work together with Jim Blackburn.
And now, Hank is no longer with Shell, and we have come together to form this private company, Soil Value Exchange.
Yeah, we want to talk about that. Are there other companies that's going to be doing the same things that's already established at this point?
There are companies that are buying and selling carbon storage in trees. I would say forest credits are very well advanced around the world, really. There are companies, there are nonprofits that are involved in this. Soil storage is very much different, and I would say that it is not nearly as widely, certainly practiced yet. I think a lot of people have recognized the potential, but there's a lot of impediments, a lot of difficulties that we'll be happy to talk about. But at this point, I don't know that there's anybody, Hank, are you aware of anyone who's actually selling stored carbon in the soil as a carbon dioxide reduction strategy?
No, there's lots of organizations that actually promote and help landowners and farmers and ranchers to store carbon in the soil, but it's not being traded. The landowners actually are not getting paid at this point in time for the service they provide to store carbon in their soil. And we want to change that off.
Yeah, we think that's wrong, that landowners should be paid.
I agree, and that's what we want to talk about because you know, farmers have a hard enough time making a living today, and why not create something to help them out and something that helps us all? So
that's where we are.
Congratulations on where you are and where you're wanting to go, and let's see if we can't get you to the next stratosphere here and move you on out. Now, are you a publicly traded company?
No.
Okay.
We basically exist as a public benefit LLC.
Okay.
We basically, the three of us own it at the current time, we are really just getting started.
Who is the third partner?
Megan Park. She is a former environmental engineer with BP, who's no longer with BP, but was there for many, many years. And so two of the partners have experience in oil and gas, and I come from the environmentalist community.
You got quite a talented team there. I looked at your website, a lot of the notes that we'll be talking today, and we'll drive some people to your website, which we can mention several times. I'd like to, which is soil, soil-value-exchange.com, soil-value-exchange.com. So if you're out there listening to the show today, you can, if you got access to the internet, you may want to kind of peruse their website. It is so full of information, and hopefully we can extract the important aspects of that today. Teresa, you got any questions?
No, I'm just sitting here looking at this, and I'm reading it. It's talking about storing CO2 in the soil. So you literally do that by doing nothing, basically, right?
Yeah, that's the beauty. Nature is doing all the work for you if you actually work with nature. So the whole concept of how do you store atmospheric CO2 or carbon dioxide in soil is a process what's happening for several billions of years on our planet. So green plants have this wonderful process called photosynthesis, where you might remember that maybe from high school biology, where water reacts with CO2 under the influence of sunlight, you form sugars. And these sugars are actually used by the plant to grow, but part of the sugars are being pumped into the root systems. And the root gives this off to microbes and fungi living in the soil in exchange for nutrients. So if a healthy plant grows, it gives a massive amount of carbon, atmospheric carbon, in the form of sugars, into the soil to the microorganisms. And that's basically how you store carbon in soil. As long as you don't disturb your soil, for instance, by plowing or tilling, the carbon will stay there almost indefinitely. That's how nature used to work.
And
basically, a lot of the management that we're talking about is, one, making sure that you maintain the carbon in the soil that the plants are actually putting there. And then, second, there are things that you can do to enhance, for example, the biodiversity of your grasses, so that you've enhanced the root system. And some of the prairie grasses that naturally occur have root systems of 6 to 9 feet deep or even deeper. And we would like to see a very robust root system, a very diverse prairie mix of grasses, and the better ecological health we've got, the better soil health that we've got, we think the healthier ranch we'll have. And so we think that, frankly, the economics of farming and ranching are benefiting along with the ecology of the soil and of the grasslands.
So I've read that because of fertilization with chemicals, you know, it helps the plants grow, but it also inhibits the growth of the roots, right?
Yeah. So actually, the more we learn about fertilizer, is the more you realize that it's actually a very short-term profit you have there. The plant goes almost on steroids, but you also start to kill basically the soil health and the soil ecology. So in the longer term, you just need to use more and more fertilizer, and it becomes less effective. But at the end of the day, you see the pastures or farms where heavy fertilizer has been used, and you see that the soil health is just reduced, and also the amount of soil carbon you store. So United States grasslands and farmlands have lost a tremendous amount of soil carbon over the last 50 years.
So
and
like
what we're hopeful of is that we will help introduce to the farmers and ranchers that want to work with us, we will help them adopt management practices that over the long term will reduce the need for fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, those types of chemicals, will enhance the rotational grazing they use, different types of concepts, and can overall enhance the soil health and kind of move away from a lot of the what we think are the damaging systems that exist right now. And in the process, put more carbon dioxide into the soil, and we can measure that, and hopefully we can sell it.
So let me just catch up here. So now you have this concept, right, that evolved since about 2010, basically with flood-related areas. So now you're identifying the carbon storage potential. Is there instrumentation that has been developed that is sanctioned now in the United States and around the world that can help monitor that to determine whether you're actually increasing or decreasing the amount of storage that you're creating?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we like, with our background in the energy industry, we like to measure things. It's not just a belief or keep your fingers crossed. We like to measure an increase. Only when you can measure it, it's really there. So the measurement standards, the measurement protocols and equipment is well known. And it's actually also accepted all over the world using the VERA standards. So soil samples are being taken on the grassland up to about 3 feet deep by drilling cores. Very carefully sampling sites are selected based on rigorous statistics and science, and then samples are being taken and they're being analyzed. So that part is very well known. Then you come back 3 to 5 years later and you sample again. And only when there's an increase in soil carbon, you have stored something, and that storage service farmer or rancher provides can actually be sold. So you're not actually selling the carbon molecules, you're selling the service that you have stored the carbon in your soil. So nobody's going to take that carbon away, and nobody can dig it up out of your soil. So the rancher farmer is in full control, but they can prove and demonstrate, and that's independently verified and validated by a third party, that they have stored carbon in soil. You can measure it. It's there.
And that's really important for the buyers that we're hoping to cultivate, because I come from the environmental community, and there's always doubt about whether representations that are made by major corporations, whether they're true or not. And the testing is really the best method that we have for actually proving that the carbon's going into the soil and staying there. And those measurements will be made over a period of years and hopefully decades, and will prove that not only is the carbon staying there, but will prove the increment of addition over time, and that's what we're selling.
So where are we in that five-year cycle? You're saying if we say you came to my farm today, okay, and we did some testing, we get the results back, okay, and we establish that. How do you measure that? What would it be? What's the scientific measurement that would be in the equipment?
So basically, we come to your ranch, we use a third party, qualified third party to do that. Have done that on hundreds of ranches. They come with kind of mobile equipment, so they can drill cores up to 3 feet deep. The cores are being sent to a laboratory, and they're basically analyzed for organic carbon. Basically, how you measure that is by burning the carbon off, and you measure the CO2 which comes off of it. You can analyze that with an analyzer and calculate how much carbon was in soil. You do that in the core, you have a core of 3 feet, and you do that several depths, so you can make a total picture of where the carbon is stored. You do that over maybe 20 to 30 something points. So it's a lot of data points.
So what's the acronym, or what's the symbol? What is that that's on the piece of paper saying that you have so much what?
Carbon, but we will translate that into tons of atmospheric CO2, metric tons of atmospheric CO2 per acre per year. That's a number which is understandable for all the carbon buyers. We're interested in metric tons of CO2.
Okay.
So the unit is metric tons of CO2 per acre per year. That's what you store. And these numbers can be from zero, or can be negative if your soil health is not that good, to something like 1 ton of CO2 per acre per year, and maybe up to 4 or even maybe higher if you have extremely healthy grasslands with a lot of photosynthesis, so a lot of rain and a lot of sunshine. So that's on the high side, 4 tons of CO2 per acre per year.
And but let me add that the initial test, when you say we come out to your ranch, this is day one, we go out, we take a measurement, we have to wait a period of time to come back and make the second measurement to actually verify how much increase there has occurred. And so our approach that we're working on and we're hoping to get adopted into essentially a voluntary United States domestic carbon standard. The approach that we're talking about is, one, you take the initial test, and then you refer to literature values. And you can begin to make sales immediately based upon literature values for the type of terrain, type of soils, types of grasslands that you're, that you have on your property. Then you come back 3 years, 5 years later and do verification testing. And at that point, adjustments will be made. You'll either be paid more than what you, you know, for tonnage that you did not sell, or you may have to make up a year or two of sequestration if you're, if you didn't meet the estimates that were made on the front end. So we have made that adjustment to allow sales to start immediately. But apart from that, it's going to be all proven out with the test number two, test number three, test number four over a period of decades.
Okay, we're talking to Dr. Heck Moyer and Jim Blackburn. This is Let's Talk Land. A minute over? Oh, you're bad boys. Bad boys.
This effort actually get underway, whether it's us or someone else, but this is something that has to happen in the United States, in our opinion.
Well, it needs to happen worldwide, I would assume. You know, get everybody on board.
Absolutely.
Teresa, got any questions?
Yeah, I've got one. This may be stupid, but
I'm trying to
understand. Is there equipment involved at the rancher's expense at the beginning, or is there any equipment that is needed?
It's a good question. In principle, no. So with our standard, we're not prescribing to any landowner what he or she should do on their land. It's their land. They manage their land. It's not up to us to determine how you should do that. That's very different from a lot of other standards. So the landowner is in full control. Having said that, there are a couple of methods which can really help you to improve your soil health and your ecological health at your ranch or farm. So what we will do is we provide grants, if we can, to give you access to free consultants who have trained thousands of ranches in the United States. With large success to manage for soil health. And that might mean that if you're interested in that, that there are ways of doing AMP grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing, or it's sometimes called rotational grazing, regenerative grazing, or holistic land management. There are all kind of different words for that. And that might require that you have to invest maybe in electric wire, that you might have to invest in some watering points so that your herd has access to water. On the other hand, if you look at the economics for a ranch, you see that the ranch becomes more profitable pretty fast in a matter of a few years. There's no heavy equipment, no fertilizer, no antibiotics, none of that stuff. So your ranch becomes more profitable. So yes, initially there might be a little investment hurdle, but we're not prescribing anything you have to do. You're in control.
Yeah, we very much think it's going to be one of these things where they, assuming one or two of the ranchers in a particular area adopt some of these practices, and they, you know, there's a conversation that goes on in most every community. We're convinced that those conversations will lead to changes in practices because people want to do something that would bring more carbon into their soil. But that's going to be dependent upon developing the price of the carbon, making it a profitable crop, and actually making carbon farming and ranching into something that is actually a major generator of income for the rancher and farmer. And we're not there yet, but we think that that will be, I predict in 5 years, it's going to be very common.
There's a couple of a few thousand ranchers in the U.S. who are at this point in time doing this type of practices some of them with very great success, and they train each other, they form networks. So that's what we try to offer as well. How can we connect you to your neighbors and to colleagues who are actually doing this type of management to maximize learning so that your risk is just lower.
Right, and bringing in the experts to actually train landowners that want to learn these techniques.
So are you guys going to provide the educational syllabus for these trainers?
So we will not provide the training ourselves because we're not ranchers, so who the hell are we? But what we're trying to do is actually provide grant, so you get access to consultants who have trained lots and lots of ranchers with a lot of experience, or a class, or you get a consultant on your ranch. So that's what we try to do.
Yeah, we've all laughed about the fact I teach at Rice University, and Rice University is not known for it's an agricultural school. It's not an agricultural school.
No, but it's a great school.
It's a great school, but to say I'm from Rice and I'm here to help you with your farming and ranching sometimes doesn't work that way.
That will probably also not work very well with my West Texas accent, so that's not the right way of helping ranchers.
No, but we're going to bring people in that know what they're talking about and make them available, and they will do the training for the people that wish to be trained.
It's the Johnny Appleseed concept, right?
Something like that. Yeah.
Now, I'm reading something on your website. It says by 2028, which is not that far away, that the Soil Value Exchange Network will extend in your business model to about 10,000 ranchers across 25 million acres together, storing equivalent over 100 million tons of carbon each year. How is carbon weighed?
So, basically, back to the measurements we've done, if you take a core and you measure that in the laboratory, you can just measure how many grams or kilograms or tons of carbon there are in an acre. So that's how you do it. It's just a measurement. So theoretically, if you would extract the carbon from your soil, which you will never do, of course, you can measure it in kilograms. And internationally in the world, all the targets for greenhouse gas reductions are all expressed in tons of CO2 equivalents. That's what the target is.
Yeah, it gets a little confusing because carbon dioxide equivalents and carbon are not the same terms, and they have different weights. I think you have to multiply carbon times 3.6 or so to get to carbon dioxide equivalents. So there's a difference. There's, 35 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions in the world. But that turns out to be something like about, 8 to 9 billion tons of carbon emitted. And a lot of confusion exists out there in the way that these terms are oftentimes interchanged. We try to use carbon dioxide equivalent most of the time.
And I find all these billions of tons very confusing because it doesn't mean anything to me what a billion tons is. But if you would do this on half of the United States grasslands, you can store at least a quarter of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So that is an important number. Half of the grasslands can store a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions.
I mean, that's huge. I mean, it makes a huge impact on the issue that is probably the most difficult issue in the world today to find any type of agreement about solutions. And here's one that's frankly right at our fingertips and is simple.
And it's not only about storing carbon, it's restoring how you absorb water in your soil, which is very important for flood and drought resilience. It is restoring the ecology, so insects and birds and wildlife come back. And it's revitalizing the rural economies for our heartlands of the country. So that's really important.
Yeah, we think this is actually, from an ecological standpoint, kind of where the future is. From an economic standpoint, it's where the future is. And we think from a social standpoint, it could have the potential to really regenerate the rural agricultural community.
I'm all for that. So these units of measurement, international units of measurements, are very well established and accepted throughout the world. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So we're not having to come up with another means of measuring and so on. It's already established. Now, the instrumentation, obviously, is set up to measure these based on those standards, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and also that is completely accepted internationally. Those protocols, how to measure, what equipment to use, how to take the samples, because that's, of course, difficult. Then you go to a 2,000-acre ranch. Where do you take the samples? So that's all figured out. Scientists have figured it out, put it in protocols and standards. That's all well known and accepted internationally, so there's no issue there.
But where the issue exists is under what terms and conditions the carbon transaction occurs. It's not a question, there's no problem with measurement, but there is a question of, if you will, what the rules of the transactions are and who recognizes what transactions. And that's where a lot of work is yet to be done.
Where are we in that process? 20%?
We're just beginning to really get that underway. I'm working with the Baker Institute of Rice University. We're putting together a working group to develop a domestic United States carbon standard that least for the transactions within the United States, would be quite different than the current international system that was set up in the Kyoto Protocol of 1997, which was really never accepted in the United States. But these existing international protocols are virtually impossible for any farmer or rancher in the United States to meet. They're very difficult in a lot of ways, which we'll be happy to talk about. But we're trying to set up a practical working standard that recognizes private property rights, that treats carbon dioxide removal and storage in the soil as essentially a commodity that you are selling, but the commodity is storage. And so we're selling the ability to store carbon dioxide in the soil, every lid in the soil. Every landowner has the right to do this. It's a, you know, or whoever owns the property or has right to manage the property may sell that. And we ask that whatever is stored must be guaranteed to stay in the soil for 10 years. Some of the international standards require, I think 20 is the least, and many of them are 40 years to perpetuity. And most of the Texas landowners we've talked to just really don't want to talk about anything greater than they are willing to talk about a 10-year commitment. And so that's what we have ended up settling upon, and we're going to see if we can gain acceptance of this 10-year commitment among a number of other types of issues.
Yeah, we'll call that crowd approval, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. We're looking for crowd approval from a group of people that would be critics, perhaps, of the oil companies for their practices. So we want to try to insulate the buyers from criticism, but we also want to include the buyers in the process so that they can have an understanding of what it is that they're purchasing. And we want to have the sellers who are involved in the process as well, and try to see if we can get a few states involved, perhaps a few Native American tribes, and begin to come up with a United States consensus. And frankly, we think it'd be easier to do that than going through the government.
I understand that, and quite an ambitious project, and sounds like you're well on your way with it. So where do we want to go next here in our conversation?
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to go into more detail about the domestic standard, but I think before we go into those details, it might be good for us to talk a bit about who might buy this and at what price.
Yeah,
and
we got about 2 minutes in this segment, okay?
Okay. Hank, you want to just give a quick overview of kind of what the pricing structure looks like that we've encountered?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So what we try to do, of course, is make it very attractive for landowners to start managing or improve how they manage for healthy soils and carbon storage. So the more value they will get for carbon farming, the more attractive it will be, and more ranchers will participate in this. So if you look internationally what the price developments of CO2 are, CO2 storage are, they can be very high. They can be 40, they can be higher. Scandinavian countries are sometimes talking about $100 per ton of CO2. We're not there in the United States, but if you look at our Canada, they're close to $40 per ton and growing. So values are going that direction of $40 per ton. We're not there yet.
No, I think what's currently maybe $12, $13 a ton.
Yeah.
You can buy carbon out on the market for that, most of that being trees.
Yeah.
And timber storage. But we anticipate if some of the carbon tax bills were to be passed, you'd have a minimum tax of $40 a ton. So that sort of sets $40 a ton as a price. We think $40 a ton is not an unreasonable price in a year or two.
Okay. Well, let's close this section. We're with Heck Mulvier and Jim Blackburn with Soils and Value Exchange in Houston, Texas. This is Let's Talk Land. All right. This is the most fascinating show, Teresa, we've had, right? It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and we need to know about it. We're real estate agents, and we're part of the Realtors Land Institute, which is part of the National Association of Realtors. And we're about 1,300 strong, so we want to get you involved with our organization. We have annual meetings. The next one will be in March in San Antonio, not too far from your backyard. So I'll talk to you about that, about how maybe being one of our guest speakers and being one of our sponsors, because that's the audience that you can educate a lot of Johnny Appleseeds very quickly. So we'll talk about that more in the future. Okay, who are the buyers? Give me a profile. I want to visualize who would be a buyer of these credits.
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, because if you have a fantastic business but you don't have a buyer, there's no business.
Right.
So it's basically at this point in time, every organization or every company who is interested in voluntarily reducing their carbon footprint, how to be called. If you have an organization or a company, you emit CO2 by traveling or using energy, and some companies are very interested because it has some value in the market, or they just want to do the right thing to reduce their carbon footprint. Those companies at this point in time are the potential buyers. Just an example is Lyft, the competitor from Uber, the car share riding company. All these car rides from Lyft are CO2 neutral because they invested in carbon storage in forests. So that's an example. There are airlines, for instance. If you buy a ticket on United Airlines or on any other airline, you can make your flight CO2 neutral by buying off your CO2 emissions. So we're looking for those targets. But if you look at a lot of the domestic companies, there is tremendous interest in moving towards green energy, so less CO2 emissions, but also in CO2 storage. So that's where the buyers are. And we don't have them lined up yet in large numbers to buy our carbon storage credits. And that's a big issue, actually, because there's 650 million acres of grasslands in the U.S. with an enormous potential to store carbon, and it's just simply hardly recognized. People are not aware, and I wasn't aware myself 6 years ago, so I'm not blaming anyone. People are not aware that there's so much incredibly reliable carbon storage in the first 3 feet of soil. People don't realize it.
Right, but then we're here in Houston. We're in the energy capital. Hink and Megan both came out of the oil industry. And so, you know, the real issue is, when will the oil and gas community begin to invest in carbon dioxide storage? And we've had some fascinating conversations with virtually with most of the major oil companies here in Houston, and it's amazing how much work is being done internally within the oil and gas industry. This is something that you really never hear about. It's not something that, at least it's, you're not going to get it on your local newscast. If you read some of the web pages of some of these companies, you begin to see it. You go to the sustainability reports of the different companies, you begin to see it. But every one of them has a team of professionals that are looking into the options and, if you will, creating a portfolio for the future, for if indeed there is a requirement that there be some sort of reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. One, they want to have options for those. They want to have strategies to meet that. And secondly, I think where you'll see the initial market develop is that there is perhaps emerging a competitive preferential position in the marketplace for carbon-neutral products. And carbon-neutral thinking is what I would point to as where the first big boom in the market's going to come from. I don't see regulation happening at the national level anytime soon. You might have a carbon tax. If the tax is at $40, we may be able to sell a lot of storage at $30 to $35 a ton. These things are in front of us, but we are finding right now an interest. It's kind of a specialized interest, but an interest on the part of buyers. And if we can get this domestic United States carbon standard established and give them some a reliable basis upon which to purchase, then I think we can see a really nice market beginning to develop in the next few years.
Now, so most of the large oil companies are very concerned about their own CO2 emissions, so they're working with a lot of people on how can we reduce that, and they work on what they call CCS, carbon capture and sequestration, or they use steel and engineers and compressors to try to pump some of the CO2 back into a reservoir. But most of them are have actually no clue what to do about the CO2 emissions of their customers, and that's the bulk of the CO2. So when you drive a car, you fly an airplane, what are you doing with that CO2? There's only a few who are doing that.
Well, and I would also say the oil and gas industry is not really comfortable with nature. And we're talking about nature being a solution. We're talking about an area that is way outside of their normal daily experience. They are most comfortable talking about how big is the pipe and how big is the pump, and you've got all of these compressors and flanges and seals and that type of thing. And we're talking about plants, and we're talking about soil, and we're talking about wetlands, and we're talking about all of these areas that are just not what they're used to talking about. So we've got a lot of educational work to do with these companies.
Having said all that, Jim, that's absolutely totally true. But we went to a couple of what they call it technical due diligence, and where they really look with a lot of experts, is our claim right? And can you store carbon in soil? And can you measure it? And it was quite a rigorous process with several companies. And they came to the conclusion, yes, this is absolutely true. This is science-based. It's robust. It can work. But then comes the big but. Will there be a market at this point in time? Will our customers pay for CO2-neutral gasoline? That's, of course, difficult at this point.
Well, that's right. It's something they're not sure about. But I will tell you, more than once we've been asked, okay, we've been talking to a group of people. They're all in the oil business. They're all they're concentrating really hard around the table. And finally, someone will ask the question, well, how big is the pipeline that I need to send the carbon dioxide to your grassland? And the idea that it's actually just taking it straight out of the atmosphere, you can put it in the atmosphere in one place and taking it out is another, is something that many of these executives in the oil industry just never conceived of. And so a lot of this is being able to communicate very clearly what these concepts are, how they work, how the carbon dioxide is stored in the soil, and then being able to sort of package it in a way that it is comprehensible to someone who's used to pumping fluids deep into the ground or out of the ground at 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 feet. With pipes and pumps and all that, and explain to them a system that involves nature.
Interesting. Wow. So are these going to be, okay, I have a farm, we put a deal together, is it going to cost me money up front in order to register and to have my property analyzed? What is the minimum amount of acres that you're looking at? I'm sure there's no maximum. Kind of talk about that for a second. And then I want to know if this can be traded, like in an open market.
So I think there's not a real minimum, but of course we were looking for scale, and we're looking for how can we reach scale fast and affordable. So, you know, a range of 500 acres, 1,000 acres, that might be perfect to start. We're not looking for something like 20 acres for now, but that might change.
I think it could change very much as the market develops. Yeah. But yeah, so I'd say size-wise, you know, we're looking for, you know, at least a bit larger piece of the property to begin with. We are proposing that the testing be done at the cost of, at our cost, or at the cost of the companies that are buying, as opposed to the individuals that are selling the carbon dioxide. We're trying to make it as easy as possible for the landowner to qualify and become a participant. It may cost the landowner some money if they need to change practices to increase the amount of carbon dioxide, but that's totally up to them.
Sure.
Yeah, that is their choice. The testing is the expense, though.
I got you. And what kind of dollars are you looking at there? What kind of dollars are you looking at there for the testing? Just, you know, it's a hypothetical, but.
So that depends strongly on the. So the answer is it depends. It depends on the type of soil, what the variety is in your range. But it can be over $10 per acre. It really depends.
Okay. Yeah, we're hopeful. I mean, the more homogenous the soil, the more it's like, you know, one or two soil types as opposed to 10 to 15. Every different soil type will have to be statistically significantly tested.
Understand.
Because we anticipate different carbon storage rates in different soil types.
Sure. But you're,
so
yeah.
We're going to learn more about that as we go along.
Sure.
There's been a bit of carbon testing out there, but, you know, there's not as much testing as you might think about this potential. I mean, it's largely been ignored by the agricultural schools. It's largely not been explored by any of the oil and gas companies, other than Shell probably has done more work on it than anyone else. And so we've got a big learning curve. We're very hopeful that we can develop remote sensing concepts eventually and come up with different things that can be measured, and we can then translate that into the body of data we have and be able to really avoid the expense that we anticipate with regard to testing. But right now, we don't see a way around having to do extensive testing, and that's probably going to be one of the bottlenecks in really moving to scale, and that's something that we will be working with, assuming we have the problem of more buyers than we can satisfy, which right now we don't have that problem.
That's okay. Got to start somewhere, guys. So
you know,
what I'm hearing is eventually there might be equipment that could actually be installed on property and stay there and continuously measure, you know, at will where you are. So that would be a goal that you'd be looking for. So you're not having to send someone out with equipment and test it and so on, but actually having some permanent equipment there once we get going.
Our permanent surveying techniques.
Yeah. Okay. Next question was about trading. Okay. I now have $20,000 worth of credit certified, and I want to sell it to Teresa. Is this something that's going to be part of this? Will there be an open market to buy and sell these credits?
I don't think we're going to be setting it up quite that way. What we will be doing is selling storage. So if you have carbon dioxide emissions, the landowner, the way we're setting it up, the landowner would sign a consignment agreement with Soil Value Exchange and allow us to use the storage capacity that they have to basically make that available to anyone who wished to store their carbon dioxide. We would make arrangements with the buyer to purchase the storage capacity on your property. That storage capacity would have would basically be entered into what we would most likely be setting up a blockchain technology over time, which would be a registry, or we would find a registry and use a registry that would give a unique identifier to every one of these parcels of land and all of the storage capacity that was available. Because one of the biggest things that we've got to be concerned about is to prevent fraud from creeping into this marketplace.
Right.
So we need to be very clear in our identification of which storage credits are being sold. And that is one of the things that Soil Value Exchange will bring, is a system of organization to keep up with this storage capacity and then to be able to allocate that storage capacity to different individual buyers. There are others who might set up tradable commodities. There are some that have talked about Bitcoin type of commodities. That's not where we're heading with our system. You may see, assuming this market develops, you could see many different variations on this, and that's why we think credibility is so important.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So I just want to move the conversation. On your website, you talk about providing grants, the Sellers Club. There are two kinds of grants for ranches and farmers. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so what this is all about is how can we make it much easier for a rancher to start from conventionally managed land to maybe regenerative managed land, so that you store more carbon and get a healthier ecology. So how can we make it as easy as possible? And that starts with ensuring that there's no investment required from a landowner at the start. So we're giving a grant for the soil carbon measurements. So a rancher or farmer doesn't have to pay a dime to get soil carbon measured. That's the first thing. The second grant we try to supply is a grant to get access to soil health consultants. If you want to, you don't have to. So to also make it easier for you to connect with experts to help you how to do this. You don't have to, but it's what we offer. So we try to make it as easy as possible to make the change there if necessary.
So you're signing me up. You're evaluating my farmer ranch. You're giving me some ideas of how to. You're establishing what my carbon storage is now, and then you're giving me ideas of how to improve that. And I can choose to do that or not. You know, it's going to cost me $10,000 to do fencing or $5,000 to dig a well or whatever those things that you recommend. But I'm not obligated to do that. It's not like I sign a contract, right?
That's correct. Yep.
Like it. All right. And there's also, you talk about water storage too. We haven't talked about that. We're just talking about land storage. Is that part of what you're doing too?
Yeah, so what you see, So the limited data we have from, and that's also always these beautiful scientific experiments where you measure on the left and the right side of the fence. So one farmer is actually doing regenerative agriculture and the neighbor is not doing it. So it's a beautiful spot to actually look at the differences. You don't only measure enormous amount of carbon on the one side and not on the other side, but you can also see that, for instance, water infiltration can be 8 to 10 times higher in a matter of just a few years. So if you get a huge rainstorm, the rains with healthy soils will contain the water, while the other soil, the water will run off and give erosion. So that's a huge benefit. You can measure that as well, but it's much harder at this point in time actually to pay someone for the water storage. But it might change. Jim, do you have any views there?
Yeah, I mean, two things here. There's two different elements here. One is flood storage, to actually take rainwater and store it in the soil and reduce the amount of runoff that goes into the river or creek or stream. And we believe that in Texas we could knock 10 to 15% off of the peak flow downstream of some of these restored farms and ranches, and could make a major impact on some of our flood protection strategies in the major urban areas. That is something that has to be studied more, that has really never been considered by hydrologists as a tool for solving urban flooding problems, for example. The other side of it is that we also believe that we'll be able to increase water supply by increasing seeps and springs or by increasing groundwater recharge. We think all of those are possibilities. And so we've got perhaps a sample project that we may be doing up in the High Plains that would involve groundwater recharge coming from restoring grasslands. We may be looking at a situation. There's a river authority in Texas called the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, where we've got an agreement that we're working with them to try to see if we can come up with concepts for enhancing the base flow of streams by increasing seeps and springs. And so we think the potential is there. The data to support quantifying these representations just doesn't exist yet. It will probably come quicker with the flood information than with the water supply, but we think all of these are ultimately additional sources of income for the farmer or rancher. Under our standard that we're talking about creating, we believe that a farmer or rancher should be able to sell more than one commodity from nature. So if you could prove a flood reduction benefit, you should be able to sell that to a downstream area that's benefited. If you can increase water supply, you should be able to sell that. So those are all issues we're looking at. And some of the current international carbon standards will not allow multiple transactions. If you're in the carbon business, you can't sell any other product off of your land, and we think that that's just crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
We're trying to help the landowners.
One thing we didn't talk about is trees. That's another area, and that's a little bit more established, right, at the current time, tree carbon credits?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly forests are as viable as soil is. We think soil is the kind of the misunderstood kind of part of the equation. Trees are much better understood. It's much better documented. But again, we probably will ultimately consider adding trees. That's just not what we're starting with.
I understand.
But, the tree storage is very well documented, and it's certainly viable. And you can get significant carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere and storage in trees. And the maintenance of forest and planting of forest over time is as valuable as a concept as soil storage is. Like we said, we think soil storage is the one that is least well understood and has the greatest growth opportunity.
So, like, for example, the planted pines, which are pretty predominant on the East Coast, especially in our area here in North Carolina, Virginia, normally, it's especially with the hybrids, you're looking 24 to 30 years to harvest a pine plantation. And what I'm reading or what I'm hearing is if the owner allows those same trees not to be harvested for 60 years, I believe was the number that I heard, that they can establish some tree carbon credits, because the whole key here is not disturbing the soil. So every time you go out and do a tree harvest, you're obviously changing the soil. and its ability to capture carbon. Is that fairly accurate?
Well, I mean, we're not talking about, in the case of forests, we're not talking about soil storage.
Okay.
In the case of forests, we're really talking about the tree carbon. And in the case of grasslands, we're talking about soil storage, and we're not interested in the carbon in the grass.
Gotcha.
The carbon in the grass never gets calculated. In the case of a forest, it's really the carbon in the trees that gets calculated, and much less actually gets into the soil, although there may be some. What I think is the most interesting potential about forests is that there's now, basically, if you cut a tree down and take the lumber and then build and put it into building a house, that carbon, or at least a significant percent of it, does not get released back into nature, but continues to be stored in the building that you're constructing. And if you then come back and replant your pine plantation, you can basically get credit, or the builder, the home builder, the construction company, gets credit for putting carbon dioxide storage into their building. And if you build with wood rather than building with concrete or cement or brick, then you're basically taking a carbon sink as a construction product, as opposed to something that uses carbon dioxide to be made. So we're rethinking. I guess what I'm saying is, you're finding that we're rethinking the entire kind of concept of economy from the standpoint of carbon and how carbon dioxide is both released and stored. And what I think you're going to find is that in 10 years, we're going to be looking at economic activity very differently. And a forest has a lot of applications that, for example, the soil storage does not. Soil storage has opportunities that forests do not. They're both part of an overall solution.
One statistic I was seeing, I want to talk about tax rates, but it says how much carbon tax raises. It says the Joint Committee on Taxation and the Congressional Budget Office estimated, for example, that a broad-based carbon tax starting at $25 per ton in 2017 would raise about 2% more than inflation would have raised $1 trillion over its first decade. That's from the Congressional Budget Office 2016. I'm sure those statistics have changed in terms of how much revenue the government's looking at making off of these carbon credits, is my point.
Well, I think that if it was a tax, I think that's what you're referring to. The government would not make any money off of any of the transactions that we're talking about. The government would not be part of those transactions.
Okay.
And I think it's the taxation that you're talking about that would generate so many dollars per ton. I think Baker Schultz's carbon tax bill has proposed $40 a ton as a beginning point, and that income, that revenue, would go to the federal government, and that, I think, is where you're getting the numbers you're talking about.
Because
we're talking about the United States government has, I mean, the whole country has about 7 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions, and at $40 a ton, that can generate a lot of money right there.
Right. But currently,
but I don't know that all of that would be taxable carbon.
I understand. But as of today, there's no taxation right established.
That's correct. There's no taxation right now, and not that much of a market, although it's beginning.
I understand. All right, with about 4 minutes left, where you want to go? We'll wrap this up for you.
Yeah, so maybe what this is about is that landowners are sitting really on top of a fabulous solution. The solution is right under our feet and their feet. And what we try to do is to unlock that enormous capital they have available. So it's about starting to finally pay landowners for the enormous service they provide to the community to store carbon, to store water in their soils. And that's not recognized now. So that's what we try to do. And we pay landowners by funding that, by those organizations and companies with a carbon problem. They have too much carbon, and the landowners and farmers and ranchers in our country can actually store that carbon and start to pay for that. That's what we're trying to do. And if you do that at scale, it will make an enormous impact on how we deal with carbon.
Right. And I come from the university perspective, being at Rice University, and you know, this is putting into practice a lot of what has been written about, but has really never been implemented. And that is really trying to realize the value that the natural system has and getting dollar payments made. Right now, those values, they're somewhat haphazard. They're not well considered. They're certainly not well managed, and they're certainly not paid for. And I think the sooner we come to realize that the landowner should be paid for ecology, if you will, and for maintenance of ecological services like putting carbon in the soil, I think the sooner we're going to have an economic system that really works well for the agricultural community and for really the rural landowner.
I love it. You got me so excited. I'm ready to go out and shout to the whole real estate industry. So
I think it's going to be something that will be shouted about, whether we're the solution or not. Somebody somewhere is eventually going to do something like this, and it has to be, as far as I'm concerned, the sooner the better.
Yeah, land and soil has much more value than we think it has.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And that adds to the value of the land, too, which is always a concern as a land broker. You know, we always look at tree assets. We look at water assets. We look at highest and best use. And, of course, now I want to add this in my conversation to my investors. And I always, anyone that buys land, I always call them an investor because it's the best investment. Right, Teresa?
I'm just wondering how we're going to make 84-year-old George T. down the road that owns 150 acres understand all this.
We're not. We're going to talk to his grandson who's going to inherit it.
Teresa. I think we're finding that the younger generation can get this a little bit easier than a lot. And a lot of people, young people that are trying to come back to the land actually are coming back to the land for these values.
Yes,
and
they are.
So we're finding that's where the receptive ears are. On the other hand, anyone we talk to about increasing cash flow will listen to us.
Oh, yeah, it. Absolutely.
Teresa, what did you learn today?
I'm not sure.
You want to sleep on it?
Yeah, definitely. It was an awful lot for someone who hasn't been in science class in 40 years to grasp.
Well, I'm sure take this script today and put it under your pillow, and through osmosis, you'll absorb it, okay?
I'm almost afraid to say this, but I think what I learned is landowners will get paid, big corporations will be paying them, and the corporations will get tax breaks for this. Is that kind of it?
If not tax breaks, they may be able to sell their products to a wider variety of audiences in the future, because the people that are buying products will become more selective about the carbon footprint of those products.
Okay, we got to close out, guys. Give us your, how do they get in touch with you?
Provide landowners with value for the service they provide by storing carbon and water in
the
soil.
And where's the Soil Value Exchange? The website?
This www.soil-value-exchange.com.
Phone number?
It's 32-641-8650.
Or 713-524-1012.
Perfect. Stay with us. Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we would appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. All shows are downloaded on our master website, www.letstalkland.net, no apostrophe, letstalkland.net, also on Podbeam, Spotify. You may also email me at lou@mylandpro.com. My cell phone number is 336-669-1405. Rodney, how do they get us at the station?
Well, they can go to our website, Lou. They can go to WKT1090 and click on our website. And also, they can download the Simple Radio app and hear us anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world.
That's right.
And we're numbered five times.
Five times and hopefully six times.
Coming up soon.
Coming up in a couple
the
weeks.
Number one beach music and oldies
station in the Triad.
In
that's
the
right.
Triad.
Well, on the East Coast.
On the East Coast.
For the award show, yes.
And congratulations on your recent award.
Yeah, thank you very much there. Yeah. Reader's Choice Award for the Radio Announcer of the Year 2019.
Radio Announcer of the Year. Wonder why.
I don't know.
Hey, we'll see you next week. Thank you for joining us.